Insider secrets of the top tech hiring managers in the industry. Know the actual intelligence behind all the successful tech hires. I'm Priyanka and welcome to Hiring Managers 101 podcast. For today's episode, we are joined by Jashmi Raman, who's the Director of Software Engineering at Capital One. Because of her extensive technical experience over the past two decades, she has acquired immense insight, which makes her, of course, the expert, and we are beyond excited to have her with us today. Welcome to the podcast, Jashmi. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Priyanka, for welcoming me to the podcast series. Looking forward to answering your questions.
Yeah, so how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Priyanka.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And, you know, to start with, can you tell us a bit about yourself and, you know, Capital One? And I'm actually very interested in knowing, like, what you found intriguing about engineering and what drew you to it as well.
I'm Jashmi Raman. I'm really excited to be part of this podcast. I have been in the tech industry for now 25 plus years. Started as an engineer. Did my undergrad actually from Pune. In computer engineering in the early 90s, and then moved to the US to get my master's in Michigan. And once I finished that, I took up my first job working for NEC as a C++ developer. Moved on to do different, working for different companies, worked for network solutions for many years, for a few years, and then I finally moved to VeriSign. And in VeriSign, I worked for probably 15 plus years, grew from an engineer to a director. And in VeriSign, I actually had some really fun times doing some cool things. Not many people know, but VeriSign actually runs the registry for .com and .net. So they actually are like run the core internet services. And I should say I was extremely lucky to be part of that core team that originally built the systems that became the core infrastructure for running .com.net. I was a developer there, learned a lot about what DNS is, worked with some really smart brains in the DNS industry, learned what it takes to build high scalable performance systems. And then I kind of moved around inside VeriSign doing different things. After my stint with actually just part of the .comnet core team, I kind of started looking at other opportunities where we were exploring things of how we can use security and DNS, marry that together, and build different products, product suites around that. And so took on different kinds of roles where it was like starting from building a team, managing a small team where we were exploring how we can build products that are brand protection based, which is like, hey, I want to provide you DNS across all the DLDs, kind of becoming like a clearinghouse for that. Hey, how can I provide you solutions that protect your brand in terms of like, hey, you know, phishing or like, you know, takedown, or and then like people would register names that are very similar. Especially like, you know, if you can think about Tiffany's.com, they would like make a small spelling mistake and this would like end up in a site that is not where they are selling counterfeit products. So that was kind of like a space that I worked in for a few years. Then moved on to do more security related things, which was more like in the vulnerability, malware detection space. This was a startup that we had acquired called iDefense, where we provided these services to our end customers, and my team focused primarily on providing a portal, providing web services and things like that for customers that provided them what kinds of malware that can potentially be available on your site, or like what are the vulnerabilities that are associated with any product suites, making you aware of how you patch them, what are the mitigation strategies around it, Moving on, I kind of like as time went on, like I, you know, kept my exploring different choices and options in VeriSign, and then ended up finally the last 5 years of my stint was as a director there, managing their DDoS and DNS platforms. So because of my DNS background, we had started thinking about how we can kind of take that DNS, which was kind of the core pieces of VeriSign, and start selling it to enterprises. And again, DDoS was a similar thing. We also had built some really high-scale DDoS solutions and platforms that were really meant for common net and registry services. Is like, how can I like expand that to the consumer markets, to the enterprise markets, and to the enterprise to big enterprises who are looking for a high scalable performance solutions. So that kind of became a focus of mine, and I started running the engineering organization for that, which kind of leveraged a lot of the things and a lot of the technology that we had already built for CommonNet, but expanding it more to the needs of the enterprise industry itself. I'll say that was probably a really fun times because I enjoyed working directly with customers, understanding what their needs were. And we had some big names. We had like FedEx, we had Wells Fargo, we had eBay, and every time there would be like a DDoS attack that some other DNS provider would have, we would always had sustained it because we knew how to run common net, and a lot of that secret sauce is what we used to give. So it was very rewarding to be part of that. Unfortunately, VeriSign made a strategic decision to actually divest that group. And since technology was kind of like the core that came from CommonNet, the plan was not to kind of divest, obviously, that secret sauce and the technology, and the technology was not going to go with it. It was actually more like just the customer base is what was sold off. So unfortunately, I had to make a tough choice at that point. It's like, I did have a role to play inside VeriSign and I could have found something to do, but I had been there long enough that I felt it was time to explore and look at something else. And that's when I started looking around, and Capital One has a huge presence in Northern Virginia, which is where I live. And also they have not only a huge, there were like many things about Capital One that had intrigued me always is they were a company that was investing heavily in tech, started as a bank, but had transformed themselves to really be solving problems using tech. And they were also big into women in tech. So with my time in technology and being a woman engineer, I felt it was time to give back and be part of a company that appreciated it, which is when I pivoted and ended up joining Capital One 3 years ago as part of credit card fraud. And again, why fraud intrigued me is it was like part of the security thing play that I had played several years in my career. It kind of was like, okay, it's an extension of that in a different way, in a different space. I mean, pivoting into financial space and using what I had done, I felt in VeriSign, grew there, I could kind of move on to Capital One doing it. And so here I am in Capital One for the last 3 years, managing some of the key platforms on the credit card fraud side. That's it.
Yeah, I think you've had quite the journey. And for me, I think it's very interesting, you know, when I get to talk to folks who are this passionate about what they do, and I'm definitely eager to hear, you know, your thoughts on, you know, various topics. And so I want to, you know, talk about, you know, finding the ideal candidate, you know, the entire process, you know, so finding the candidate with the required skill sets. And we have a very limited talent pool in a very competitive market. So it's a very tedious process and it does require a great deal of expertise as well. So let's say you're hiring techies for certain skill sets. So what are some parameters you have in mind? And so how would you go about the entire assessment strategy? And What variations of assessments would you use to qualify them
Okay,
on various
so
aspects?
it, I mean, when you end up hiring, you are obviously building teams. You're looking at like what your requirements are. So there is a big piece of that. The strategy that we have, I mean, most of the organizations that I have now worked with is have kind of gone through the transformation of being agile teams, and also more of a philosophy of whatever you built, you own that. So we have for more than a decade or so, I would say like my journey has completely shifted into this world of like, hey, you build, you own your solution. You also have these nimble teams that own a certain piece of code and they build that out, right? So for that, you know, for building that team out, the techies that you get in, you it's typically a team of like 5 to 6 engineers is what kind of is ideal for an agile team to be really successful. And so it starts off as like, okay, what is the, when you need to first understand like, okay, do you have any people on the ground at all? Now, if I'm starting from ground zero and building this entire team out and hiring this entire team, I want different skill sets. I also want different levels of experience. And that's how I first start off like laying out how I'm going to go about hiring, right? So so there are different strategies that I have used and in the different organizations that I have been part of. So at the lower end, we always like to hire students that are fresh out of school, fresh out of colleges, right? So what we've done typically is gone after different tiers of colleges and looked at their talent pool and gone through hiring from there, where typically in each of our teams, we end up getting 1 or 2 engineers out of that pool. And when we do the assessment, so our assessment typically has certain key strategies. One is like just your, are you a good coder? Because as a techie, that's the main thing. Is you have to be able to code effectively. Your quality of code has to be good. Obviously, at every level, it's a different expectation of that quality of code. But that is, I think, the most important thing. So we always start off, no matter what level I'm hiring, we always start off with a code assessment. And the way I think about this is, it doesn't matter what language you write your code in. And that is something we make it very, very clear. Is like, we first want to make sure that whatever language you feel you're comfortable with, you're able to write clean code and you're able to solve the problem that you have. So that's our starting bar. Once you have crossed that bar, and so we assess that quality of code, make sure that they have understood the problem, make sure that they have solved the problem in the right way. And depending on the level that I am hiring, I'm going to be looking at the strategies that they have used. Like for instance, at a higher level guy, I'm going to look at like, hey, is he good about reuse? Is he good about refactoring? Is he good about those kind of entities? Versus somebody who is at the low level coming in, is like, has he solved the problem? Does he understand the problem? Right? So that's like, is the first step. Then we go into at least two types of interview process is what we typically end up using. One is like the job specific skills itself. And that is purely problem solving, right? So again, when somebody is fresh out of college, I think the things that we focus on, that I like to focus on, is their core principles of, do they understand what data structures mean? Do they understand using the right data structures for right problem solving? Do they understand what kinds of algorithms exist and how can I effectively use an algorithm to solve the problem, right? And sometimes, the job-specific skill interview is more like giving a problem and seeing their thinking process to solve that problem, right? I am not looking at that time of like their language-specific skills. Like, I'm really trying to understand, do they have the capacity to, given a problem, are they able to solve that problem effectively? using some of the core computer science principles, right? So again, different levels, the expectations would be different. Again, when somebody is coming brand new out of school, they do not understand how to build a performance scalable solution. That's not the expectation. The expectation is, do they understand the problem? Do they use the right algorithms? Do they have the right thinking process to solve the problem, right? Whereas as the level goes up, my expectations are going to increase. Like, hey, if it's somebody who has got a 10 plus years in the industry experience, I'm going to be pushing them on things like, hey, have you thought about resiliency of platforms? Have you thought about scalability of platforms? How do you go about solving those problems? How do you think about latency requirements and things like that, right? So the format, I would say, is very similar. So it's always like a coding problem. It's always a job specific skills, like it's like how well you understand your basic fundamentals of computer science. And then the last thing comes to your execution piece. Then depending on the languages that they've said, what they like as part of the job specific skills, I also like them to do code reviews and see the understanding of code that they have, how good they are about understanding their code. We also look at doing, as part of that, just looking at the code, we also make them do like, hey, tell me how you can refactor this code and make it more effective, right? So that's another piece that I look into. And again, I always go with like, hey, what's your language of preference? And then we push on things like, how do you do about new languages learning? Because that's, I think, a very important thing in the software industry, is adjusting, learning, and grasping new skills. So that's, I think, a key element that we look at. So those, I think, are probably some of the key elements and factors that I look into when we are doing the interview process.
Yeah, I think you've shared a very well thought out, you know, approach to assessing the right fit. But I still feel like many companies end up having a very lengthy assessment process. And I think many skilled candidates lose interest because of this, because, you know, honestly, no experienced candidate would want to spend hours, you know, taking so many rounds of assessments. So how do you suggest them to keep the process crisp and, you know, streamlined to only what is required?
So what I have found it very effective is not spread the interview over several days and several rounds. And that kind of keeps the candidate interested. At the same time, we get to assess the candidate well and look at the all-roundedness of the candidate. So what's worked effectively for us is we typically do one phone screen. And as part of the phone screen, the code assessment is given to the candidate right away. That becomes our first bar to ensure that we got the right candidate. Because if you fail the code assessment, then there is no point in us moving forward with the right candidate, right? So there is like no waste of time either for us or for the candidate in that process, right? So that is your first bar. Once you're through that bar and you have accomplished that, you've proved to us that, hey, you are a good candidate, then I like to do like just a half, it's a series of three to four interviews, again, depending on the level. For the lower levels, we have about maximum of 3 hours of interview. As the level goes up, typically we end up doing like 4 or 5 hours of interview. I know it feels like, oh my God, it's a dream. But I think it's important that you get input from different people, have different assessment strategies, and they look at different skills, and then we are able to make a more collaborative assessment. As the critical thing is about not spreading these 4 hours, starting with from the 3 hours to 5 hour interviews is what we typically end up doing for our engineers. So the fact that as long as you are able to give them a chunk of 3 hours, it's half a day block is all I'm expecting from the candidate's perspective, right? So we try to make sure that upfront, you give us a 3 hour chunk so that it's half a day of your day is all being spent. There are 3 interviews being conducted, which is instead of spreading that over 3 days. And we've seen that that is typically works very well. So finally, it's the decision-making process. So the way we expect all our interviewers go through a full training process, and we have done this in both my companies, in VeriSign as well as in Capital One, where we go through an intense training process of our interviewers in what is expected, what they need to assess, and how they actually write a report about the candidate itself. So when we come to a consensus call, and this is an expectation from each of our interviewers. So when we come to a consensus call, as a hiring manager, I have no data from either 3 to 5 interviewers about this candidate in terms of what, how they have, each one would have assessed them at different levels. And we kind of like make sure that our job specific skills problem sets are different from each other, so that they are looking at different kinds of thought processes that the candidate has. So this is a more we are holistically comprehensively looking at the candidate. And with those inputs that are coming from everywhere, we do a quick 20-minute call with all the interviewers. First, look at the fact that, hey, do we agree? What is the consensus? And if the consensus is yes, just making sure that, you know, we've heard everybody's viewpoint, and if there are any red flags, take that into account. If the consensus is no, again, like, why is the consensus no? If the consensus is like maybe split, then we really kind of like focus more on why somebody feels it's a yes versus a no. What are the big parameters that they are looking into? And then ultimately, it's the hiring manager's decision based on all the inputs that they have gotten. What's their decision? Do they fit their role? So that's kind of like the... And this has been pretty effective for us, giving back the response by the recruiter to the candidate on a timely fashion is important. So I think it's about scheduling the calls in a timely fashion, scheduling the response in a timely fashion, ensuring that the candidate is being upfront. So there is a lot that falls on the recruiters that ensure that you let the candidate know the expectation and don't keep them hanging. Right, that's where the candidate is going to lose why they would like to even think about pursuing that. Yeah, so those are, I think, the techniques that I think we've used, which have been pretty effective.
Yeah, I think I completely agree as well. And I think asking the right questions is also very essential, you know, when you're trying to hire the right fit. And I think it's something which I think most companies are still trying to crack. And what they lack is the clarity on what they're looking for in the candidate. And they usually end up with a very lengthy and vague job descriptions instead of actually like narrowing down the skill sets, which is actually required. And I think that becomes their very major hurdle. And following that, I think them working on the entire strategy of questions as well. And so I want to know your take on, you know, each of these key steps and how can they uncomplicate this whole process and refine it.
Okay, so what we have done in this world currently, at an engineer, there is an expectation that an engineer can adapt and change and move. So we don't hold them to a particular team, to a particular area. We kind of think about, like, are they going to fit in our culture? So which is where we talk about, like, hey, are they going to be able to, at the lower levels, are they able to learn new technologies, right? So our assessments for job-specific skills for the lower tier of engineers are common across the organization. We have about 4 to 5 different problem sets that we keep refreshing. And these problem sets are well defined, like, which is where I talked about, like, you know, some of the problems would be like, hey, look at the code, and it will be like, hey, can you make sure that you can refactor the code? What are the flaws in the code? Is this code going to work well? So there is a whole problem set that's just going to be looking at the code itself and commenting about it. There is going to be a problem set that's going to be like, hey, please write a code to solve a particular problem, right? So we create these 4 to 5 different problem sets, and the interviewers choose. There is no overlap. Not two interviews can use the same problem set, right? So when we end up choosing two job-specific skills, we end up using two different, both the interviewers have to use different sets of problems to do the actual problem solving, right? So this is kind of the pattern that we have leveraged, where we have the techies from the company come together and define these problem sets in advance. So you are really hiring for the organization and not necessarily a team. That's the first thing, right? Now, so this is more like when you are like choosing grads right out of college. That's kind of the strategy that we end up using. Now, for people who are more experienced, so when it comes to 7+ years of experience, where I think of them as the leads, and some of the times it's not even the number of years of experience. There will be engineers that are so smart, like even at like 5 years, they have the maturity, right? We use a little bit different strategy for them. There is obviously the core assessment that they have to still go through, and there is obviously one or two problem sets that they will end up solving from these five or six problem sets that we have co-defined. But there are some other pieces that we will specifically look at from the product that I have itself. So for instance, if I have a web-based application, full stack developer that I'm looking for, then I am going to be specifically focusing on their experience in, like, let's just say the stack is maybe an Angular JavaScript, and the backend is microservices using either Lambdas or using Java or using Python, whatever it is, right? So for a lead position or somebody who is going to be driving a subcomponent, the strategy is going to be a little different, where I'm going to be focusing more on these language skills that they have. Do they have experience in JavaScript? What is their experience in JavaScript looks like? What kind of systems have they built, right? What kinds of problems have they solved as part of that? How did they architect the solution? If they decided to go down the microservices path, or did they decided, like, especially with AWS Cloud and things like that coming, like, have they looked at Lambda solutions? What are the pitfalls of Lambda? So those become my focus areas, right? So I am now more driven based on actually the platform, of what the language set that the platform ends up using. So that's kind of like how we do interviewing for more like the senior engineers in the organization or the architects in the organization. So the strategy is slightly different when it comes to that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, completely. And I think you've rightly said the gaining the clarity is very key, and it will surely save a lot of time and efforts as well. And, you know, you'll be able to make more successful hires as well. And as important as it is to, you know, make great hires, it's also very important to provide them like a very inspiring and compelling work environment, which, you know, motivates them to push beyond the digital boundaries as well in the industry. So what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so here's where I think the hiring manager plays a very big role. And generally what we've seen being very effective is what we call it as a self-call. So in the interview panel, we like to generally have the interview panel have the hiring manager as part of it. But there have been situations when the organization is too large that maybe the hiring manager was not part of the interview panel, has not had a chance to talk to this candidate. So it's important for the hiring manager to provide the big picture of the product, the platform, and how their day-to-day work. So talk about actually the product and the platform itself and how you can make an impact. Like for me, like, I guess things have been easy in some ways because I used to be part of ComNet, so I could always talk about the impact that you would have about the ComNet registry, or like providing DNS solutions or DDoS solutions to enterprises. So every code, that line of code that you publish, has such an impact on what you do, right? So it's about how you're touching the customer. Now in the credit card fraud world, the story is about something that every customer experiences, that, hey, I've had a fraud on my credit card, and how do I go about, how our systems go about solving those problems, and how you can be part of this team that can be solving those problems. So that is, I think, the first piece about actually your product platform, giving them the big picture and showing how they can be playing a critical role in that. That's important. The second is about the culture itself, right? So it's important that you talk about investing in your people. And that is something that I'm very passionate about, where, you know, what we do is we run mentor-mentee circles, we run mentor-mentee programs. And so these programs are important for us to talk to. So depending on what level you are, what kind of mentorship we have, we make sure that my teams, I make sure that we provide that growth and have those conversations with our engineers. So emphasize on that part of it, right? What is it that excites them? Is it new technology learning, or is it somebody who wants to really grow as a people leader? So ensuring that we will set you up for success is important. The last thing is, I think this is huge. For a techie, he gets bored very quickly. So it is important that you show them, and that's why they start looking for jobs outside. Is the retention is important. And again, when you have a larger organization, there are more ways of doing it. But even in a smaller organization, it's important that you talk about the culture and you also imbibe this culture where people can move around onto different platforms, different teams. Teams are teams of 5 people, 6 people solving a problem, right? Now, if I own 10 teams of those kind, what I do is I open up the culture of like, hey, let's move these engineers around. It's a scary thought sometimes for managers to think about it, right? Hey, now I just trained this guy. I'm going to be using this guy. I need to retrain a new guy. So this, it's a little bit scary, but honestly, trust me. I've been effectively doing this now in my company for the last 5 to 6 years or even more. And what the benefits we see is you do not lose talent. People don't feel stagnated. They are learning new things. You are on your toes. Engineers are not constantly like, oh, I'm in a safe zone or I'm in my comfort zone. You in fact want to push your boundaries constantly to be in a non-comfort zone because that's when growth comes. So it's important that you give your engineers this thought process during the hiring itself. And this is what we call as a cell call. So we do 20 minutes of cell calls with the smart engineers or managers or whoever techies. This is typically done by either the hiring manager itself or me as a director. Sometimes I do it for my, even if I'm not a hiring manager, it could be one of my managers hiring. I do it for the engineers in my, or to show them what kind of a leader I am and what kind of a leaders that I want to build, what kind of a culture I want to build, right? And that is, I think, a very critical thing for an engineer ultimately to look at.
Yeah, I think companies need to work more on, you know, creating a very positive work environment, and they should have a lot of, yeah, you know, digital collaborations as well. And always, I think, provide a lot of opportunities for learning because it ultimately facilitates their growth and the, you know, employees as well. And it will increase the productivity and the efficiency of the team as well as the individual itself. So, yeah. And so when it comes to managing teams, so how do you encourage innovation and foster the diversity, equity, and inclusion? And so there are these other factors like, you know, outside of the box thinking, teamwork, and self-organization. So how do you think they contribute to this whole thing?
Yeah, so what we've done that's worked effectively is actually define innovation days, like predefined innovation days. So, and we kind of like foster this at every team level. We make, let the team decide what makes sense for them. There are teams that come back and say like, hey, every other Friday, we want it to be an innovation day, right? And what we are doing as part of that, you know, or maybe every month, we're going to take 2 days and those are going to become our innovation days. This is something that's predefined and we already make it part of our culture, right? So our product partners know that this is part of our day-to-day activities, that it is included in that. As part of, and but those innovation days, those alternate Fridays or two days in a month are not days for you to go wild around and have fun. Those are days for you to solve real problems, right? So we in fact actually have a whole backlog and a storyboarding that is done for innovation. And this could be, hey, I want to, it could be like there is a problem that you are trying to solve, but you've not had the time for it. It could be like, hey, I want to use something called, as I'm just giving you an example, like DMN is a standard for defining rules, but we have not used it. We maybe use just like an if then else statements. So, but there is somebody who has read up about DMN and wants to explore how DMN would work for this product that they're working on. So it could be that that's an innovation idea that he wants to try. So they will create, the team will then say, we'll have like the brainstorm and come up with all these bunch of ideas that they will then leverage these innovation days to in fact experiment with new technologies or with new things that they have read and figure out, hey, can I build a proof of concept around this? Is there traction that I can do with this? So that's one of the ways that we have fostered, we have kind of like brought that in the culture itself. What is another thing that's worked very well is we actually define hackathon days. Like we do a hackathon. Like those have really worked well. So this is like going back to those ideas that everybody has. So we've taken like, maybe let's just plan on a 3-day hackathon at the end of every 6 months, right? And make it fun. Like create teams. It doesn't have to be just your teams. This is gives the organization exploring beyond your own team. Like, hey, let me cross team work across to create a small sub team that is now going to be solving a particular innovation problem, right? So, and they get 3 days to solve it. And then we have competitions around it, of course, and awards and, you know, things like that. And sometimes some really interesting problem solving we've seen that comes out of it. So highly, highly encourage hackathons and a well-defined innovation time for the team. And that's worked extremely well for us.
And companies should definitely prioritize this because I think the whole process nurtures the talent a lot and I think makes them feel valued and it results in a lot more creativity and a very healthy and comfortable workspace as well. And it's in the end beneficial for the both organization and employees because it adds a lot of value to the organization as well. So
totally. And this is where I think a lot of companies miss it. They think if you give away these 3 days or 2 days that in a month or in a quarter or in 6 months, you are losing productivity of the people. In fact, it's the other way around is what I would say, because the investing in the people energizes them. They learn problems. They get more creative and they are able to learn solving the problems sometimes even in a better way, right? Because a lot of the problems are generally what we encourage them to do is adjacent to the problem space that you're working on. And that ends up, in fact, providing growth opportunity both to the company as well as to the individual, which is, I think, a good, happy place to be in.
Yeah, very true. And I want to know if you have any ideas you can share with us on how to increase the accountability as well as like fostering a culture of excellence.
So accountability, I think that is like a very, it's an inherent, I think what I, the you own, you build philosophy that kind of came about 10 years ago, I think automatically builds the accountability. I think this is like really big in teams in Amazon and Google and all of that, which I know has spread out to other organizations. And in Capital One, we leverage that quite a bit, where accountability gets built in so many ways. When you have the situation of whatever you own, whatever you build, you own, there are multiple aspects to it. As a developer, I am writing lines of code and I'm pushing it into production to solve a problem, right? That's what I do day in and day out. Now, to the accountability I'm pushing on my when I'm saying that you, whatever right code you've written, you own it, is if that code was supposed to do XYZ and it fails in production, you are going to get paged in the middle of the night. You wake up and solve it, right? That pushes automatically the thought process that I want to write good quality code. Because if I write crappy quality of code, it is not some system administrator sitting somewhere that's going to be woken up and is going to be troubleshooting. It is me that is going to be woken up in the middle of the night. If I want to have a peaceful night of sleep, I better write good quality code. So I understand my requirements better. I test it well. I make sure I push good quality code out to the production, into production, because ultimately, if I want peace of mind and a good night's sleep, I don't have to be woken up. So I think that culture by itself forces accountability. Is you do not want to write crappy software that is not going to sustain by itself, and it is not somebody else's job. It is your job. And when you work in a team of like these 5 to 6 engineers with this kind of philosophy, not everybody is on pager duty every day. You are taking turns and doing the pager duty. But if it is, if there is an automatic accountability that you start pushing on each other. So it's like there is a self. There is also this, hey, you wrote and pushed this code. XYZ wrote this code and pushed it yesterday, which caused the problem. And there was a person A who solved that problem, right? And if that becomes a culture that person X always writes crappy code, the rest of the team is going to call that out and going to push the accountability on the person who is not writing good code, right? So that automatically drives that. So I think this culture of you build, you own, in many, many ways pushes engineers' accountability. So I feel like instead of a manager coming and saying, this self creation of this and building this accountability by itself, I think solves it to a certain extent. And obviously, if things don't work in a natural way, there are always other ways of pushing accountability, right? This is where, you know, good performance management, having good people leaders, that hold their team accountable is important, and having those critical, hard conversations with your engineers if they are not producing good quality code or if they are not learning automatically is also an extremely important thing to be done, which is something that every people manager should also be doing. So I think there is like the team level accountability, and there is also a people leader level accountability that is critical. But I prefer to impose the team level accountability first, and the people leader level is really more about, comes into play when things are really just not being self-directed.
Yeah, I think it'll end up breeding a lot of trust as well, and it'll enhance the productivity, and it'll lead to better work relationships, I feel. And it'll definitely increase the retention of the workforce as well, because now there is an improvement in the whole employee satisfaction. And, you know, you own what you build. So, yeah, the retention as well will increase for the organization. And so we know that it's like very essential to maintain good relations with both internal and the external stakeholders. But I think more often than not, like there is a communication gap and like a disconnect between hiring managers and recruiters. So what are your thoughts on this, and how can they work together and improve their relationship to align their goals? And can you also shed some light on the importance of these relations?
Okay. So I think it's first of all extremely important for the hiring manager and the recruiter to have a conversation about what kind of hiring I plan to do, which is all about setting the right expectations. It starts from there, right? So I believe in a few things. Like I call them the 3 P's: trust, teamwork, transparency. Those are the 3 D's is what I always say. So when you start from a hiring manager's perspective, I think it's important to have that open, transparent communication with the recruiter to lay out what's expected, right? It's like what kind of hiring I'm looking at, what kind of a person I'm looking to hire, right? So setting that, defining the job requirement precisely, and then communicating and talking about that to the hiring manager, to the recruiter is an important task, right? And then having constant checkpoints around this, like what kind of resumes am I getting? If the quality of resumes is not good, let's just sync up quickly and talk about what's wrong here, right? And then I think it's critical for the hiring manager to call out for the recruiter if things are not going well, if they're not bringing the right set of candidates that they're looking at, because let's not waste time here, right? So I think that is a very important aspect. And from recruiters, I think the hiring manager should also be like setting expectations with the recruiter about the right conversations to have with the candidate itself. Is not setting, goes back to like, do not set wrong expectations with them, right? Whether it comes to your salary requirements. And so this is something that I encourage generally our recruiters to do, is to actually in the initial conversation itself, talk a little bit about what is their salary expectation, right? Again, you don't want to be going through the entire process and find at the end of it that you cannot afford this person for whatever it is, and they are not going to be this frustrating for everybody. So let us again be more transparent about it and upfront about it, right? So this goes back to like providing the, it is important for the hiring manager to provide the recruiter the min-max kind of like range, right? Like, hey, I as a company cannot afford to go beyond a certain dollar amount maybe, or hey, this role is so important to me that for the right candidate, I'm willing to go 20% more than what it is, what like the generic market rate is, right? So it's super critical for the hiring manager to be very clear and crisp about what their requirements are and communicate that to the recruiter, and then manage that through like constant touch points. I think it's important to maybe like do like a weekly check-in with them on what's going on, right? On like, hey, on, and giving them the feedback to the recruiters about like how the process is going, what kind of and how and what is expected out of them to have those external conversations. So that's what I have generally seen. And don't be afraid to fire recruiters if they are not bringing you the right candidates, right? I think that's the other aspect too, is like, let's not waste any more time if I'm not getting the right candidates and right set of people. So that's, I think I would say, and the reason I said the three T's is the trust, because I trust you as a recruiter. Transparency is, let me be very clear. And teamwork is, it's ultimately the teamwork effort of the hiring manager, the interview panel, and the recruiter itself to get the right people on the bus.
I think everything can be solved with, you know, proper communication. And I think there wouldn't be a dysfunction if the goals are established and if everyone's on the same page. And usually I think it leads to a dysfunction because they try to bridge it when it's gone way out of hand. And when, you know, instead of simply start to focusing on it from day one, I think then it would make things a lot easier and more efficient as well. And yeah, I think before we wrap up our conversation, I wanted to ask, so your experience in the industry spans over to more than two and a half decades. So how was the industry back then when you started out and fast track to like today? So how has it evolved over time? And can you share with us any key takeaways from the years and which has shaped your approach?
Okay. So I think the first thing strikingly is women in tech, right? So when I started, even when I did my undergrad, my engineering, I think we were like, I was probably like a 5% or 7% of the women population at that time that would actually do engineering. So, and like the workforce was a similar thing. So there was obviously a dearth of diversity, dearth of women. And so that, I think, the focus that we have had over the last few years, we're still nowhere close to 50-50, but I think the focus that many organizations and even colleges are doing in terms of making sure that we choose diverse candidates, I think has become a key difference from what I see. And since my entire work life has been in the US, I used to always be this token brown girl in a room full of white men. So it is not that anymore. That is one of the biggest differences that I see from what it was once upon a time to what it is today. Mm-hmm. So that's I think a very good change that I see. The second big change is, I think it's about the demand supply, I would say. I don't think the tech industry was this hot and booming in the mid-90s when, towards the end of 90s, it started booming. But it wasn't that hot when we initially started, and especially for somebody who was fresh out of school. It wasn't like you had a red carpet in front of you, but that's a big change now. It's like we, and especially the big four, again, Facebook, Amazon, Google, the way they have changed the generation that is graduating out of colleges, that sometimes the outlook for them that I feel like sometimes this generation might be feeling that, hey, I am entitled. There is a feeling of entitlement, which I don't think when we got out of college, we had that feeling of entitlement. So that is one aspect that I do worry about, is this generation, as these millennials and Gen Zs kind of come into the workforce and have to go through the ups and downs of the industry, are they ready? For the world may not be always be that you have this feeling of entitlement and you're going to get it all, right? So things might be different, and there has probably they have to go through some learning curves later on in their lives. So that's, I think, the other aspect.
Everyone has a lot to learn, I think, from your experiences, and I think it would definitely help them in building a very successful hiring strategy as well. And that brings us to the, you know, end of our conversation. And I had a wonderful time chatting with you, Jashmi. And I think our conversation was very thought-provoking, and you've shared some really great in-depth insights as well with us. So thank you so much for speaking with me, Jashmi.
Sure. Thank you, Priyanka. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Hiring Managers 101 podcast. We hope you enjoyed as well as learned from it. To gain more such insights, join us for our next episode. You can follow us on LinkedIn at Technical Hiring Showcase page and our website technical-hiring.com to receive all the updates. That's all for this episode, folks. See you next time.